This is 4:55 on Friday, October 28th. 2 hours. Okay. Well, all right. Oh, yous are here. I'm here. They're not. So, onward we go. So, just to say a couple more words about the CRC business. The question that goes on the exam requires you to know the role of the G, the R, the D, the extra bits, the little r, and how to do the division. All right? So you are warned.
Wait, what is that little r?
The little r is the number of additional bits. Okay? And notice that G is one bit longer than that. So G is called the generator for the particular CRC code and is fixed across all the users of, of that particular code. The capital R is the remainder and is also used as the checksum. And D is the original message to which you append little r extra zeros for doing the calculation, and then you do the calculation. Okay? So, just want to be clear about that.
And in that notation there, that almost looks like a dot, but it's in...
it's D time. It's D time. Well, I mean, he's used 2 here, right? But it's D times 2 to the r. Or D times X to the R in the way that I expressed it, which means essentially appending those zeros.
So not a dot product.
Not a dot product, no. Multiplication. Okay. All right, onward. Multiple access protocols. So point-to-point links are links that go from one host to another. They have two distinct ends, right? And multiple access is not an issue for those if they're full duplex links because both sides can be sending simultaneously. So we're not talking about those. We're talking about links that involve some kind of broadcast where different senders sending at the same time can interfere with each other. And in that case, we have to do something to arrange so that that interference doesn't wipe out the communications. So examples of this are, of course, our wireless LANs, anything involving sort of radios pretty much. The original Ethernet design is a broadcast medium. And what's interesting about this, part of the reason that we talk about this these days is that although old-fashioned Ethernet was a broadcast medium and modern-day Ethernet largely is not, there's still sort of a lot of cruft about the way networks work that was determined way back when. And so, you know, there are sort of implications of how modern day networks work that come from that old fashioned Ethernet design. Okay, so we have a broadcast channel. We have two or more nodes sending at the same time, and when that happens, receivers can't understand what is going on. This is like being in a location where on the AM radio band, you know, if there are two stations that are transmitting on the same channel, you just get gibberish out of it. The receiver can't understand what's going on. So to solve that problem, we need what is called a multiple access protocol, which is a set of rules, as always, that's what a protocol is, that determines when each node is allowed to send and when it must be silent. And although it doesn't, although there are situations in which communication about channel sharing happens on other channels, that's not what we're going to talk about. Right? That's called using an out-of-band channel for coordination, and there are situations where that occurs, but those are less interesting in some sense than the ones where you don't have that additional capability. Okay, so we're after a multiple access protocol, and what would be the ideal situation for ideal characteristics of such a protocol? It would be that if only one node wants to send, it can send it at the full rate of the channel. If a bunch of nodes want to send, then they each get a fair share of the channel, and that there wouldn't have to be any sort of centralized coordination to achieve that, and that it would be simple. That, those are the sort of most desirable characteristics. What we're going to see is we're going to see a bunch of multiple access protocols that achieve these ideal characteristics to various degrees, but none achieves all of them. So, how to sort of again understand this by breaking it up into different classes of things. One way to do it is to set up a set of rules that say, you have your turn and I have my turn, you have your frequency and I have my frequency. That's a sort of channel partitioning scheme, and we will talk about the consequences of that in relationship to the ideal. Another scheme is what are called random access protocols. These have different characteristics. We allow collisions in these schemes and then figure out how to deal with them, basically. And finally, there are what are called taking turns protocols that the nodes somehow coordinate their use of the channel in a distributed way, but don't have strict pre-assigned shares. So that's what we'll sort of tour through here in a second. So we've talked about this one before. Time division, multiple access. Everybody gets assigned a slot in which they're allowed to transmit. And of course, the problem with this one is that because everybody is assigned a slot, nobody can use the full bandwidth of the channel, which was one of our desired characteristics. You only get your share, and that's all you ever get. And the other problem is that you actually have to synchronize the clocks between the stations, right? Because everybody has to agree on where the slot boundaries are and which slot is assigned to somebody. So somebody has to assign slots, right? So there's, although it seems like it's a simple solution, it comes along with some complication that also has to be solved. So some protocols do work this way, but not ideal because you really can't use the full bandwidth. But when everybody's busy, this one is pretty efficient. Right? If everybody has something to say all the time, then this one will produce fair sharing amongst the senders. Similarly, frequency division, multiple access, we talked about this before too, different colors of light, if you will. I send my signals on the blue channel, you send your signals on the red channel. Again, it gives fair sharing. It doesn't require clock coordination. It does require somebody to assign the channels. Okay? And again, we can't, nobody can use all of the available bandwidth.
How fine can they divide frequencies up?
Okay, well, let's see. That's a fine question, and we can get a sense of it from looking at... So, my recollection is that the 802.11 ABG frequency band is between 2.4 gigahertz and 2.45 gigahertz, or maybe 2.5 gigahertz. There are 11 channels assigned within that range, and in fact only three of them are usable. Okay, because they interfere with their channels. Okay, so the question of how fine you can divide the channels depends on how fast you want to send on each channel, and this is something that the computer engineers should be able to explain to us. Any computer engineer want to explain the bandwidth of a signal carrying information at a given rate? No takers? Okay. Okay. Well, it depends on how fast a channel you want. A channel carrying information at a certain rate needs to be a certain bandwidth. Okay. And how that works exactly is not something I've studied for 35 years. So, I like to live one layer of abstraction above that. But I recognize the value of people who don't, because without them, we wouldn't have any of this stuff. So that's good. All right. So notice, so one observation along those lines is that, for example, when you get into optical fiber with multiple colors, the bandwidths associated with those frequencies are so high associated with the colors that they can carry a lot of information very fast. Because going from blue to red is moving by many, many, probably terahertz even. Okay. So that's why optical fibers are in fact able to carry information at such high rates. Yeah, Matt. Ah, oh, cool question. I like that question. So it depends on what kind of router it is. A router that's, say, connected to one of these, say, optical fibers with different color light on it can work by essentially turning the light back into electrical signals and operating as a layer 3 router, right? Which means that it has to look at the network level information. So it really does have to see the bits inside the signals. At layer 2, that is the link layer, you can build you can build switches that you can build purely optical switches, essentially, that switch the packets just as burst of colored light onto different outputs. Okay. And I believe that there are some at least experimental switches that can change the color of the light as it goes through. Right? So the answer to your question is yes. Okay? In sort of lots of different ways. But if it's operating as a router, right, then it really has to take apart the signal and see the bits of the network address in order to know what to do. Okay. Cool question. I like that question. Okay. So those sharing protocols, the big drawback is the need for central coordination to assign the slots or the frequencies, and the fact that they can't actually use the full, no single node can use the full bandwidth. So that's where we come into these random access protocols, which get much closer to the idea that when a node has something to send, it goes at the full rate, and if it's the only one sending, then it can sort of continuously go at the full rate. There's some overhead associated with the protocol, so it doesn't really quite reach the full rate, but it gets pretty close if it's the only one going. If two nodes try to send on a random access protocol, then they're both sending, you get one of these collisions, right? And that both communications are destroyed by that. Nobody wins. You've wasted time sending signals that can't be received, right? So that detracts from the available capacity of the network when you're wasting time doing things that can't be received. So a protocol then has to specify what you're going to do about collisions and how you're going to recover from them. And we're going to go through sort of go through at least those four at this point, and I think we'll save collision avoidance for when we talk about wireless. So I'll spell those out. Well, Aloha is, I don't know what Aloha stands for, actually. I think it stood for something once upon a time, but it was cleverly named because it was created by the University of Hawaii. and so everybody remembers it for that and not for what it stands for. So it was used in setting up a radio network between the University of Hawaii and some volcanic measurement stations or something having to do with volcanoes or astronomy or something like that. Anyway, we'll talk about a simplified version of it first, that's called slotted Aloha, in which all the frames, remember frames are the link layer chunks, all the frames are the same size, time is divided into slots, and the rule is that you only start transmitting at the beginning of a slot. Well, this immediately poses the need to say, well, what do we do for time synchronization to determine where the slots begin or not? We'll defer that. Now if you have two nodes that try to send in the same slot, there will be a collision, and that will be detected, and you throw away the garbage and try again. So the rules are, when you have a frame to send, when you first get a frame to send, from where does it come from? The upper layer. When you first get a frame to send, you just try to send it. at the next at the beginning of the next available slot. And if you don't hear a collision associated with that, which means you don't hear that your transmission got destroyed, you're able to send again in the very next slot. But if there is a collision, then you do what's called a back-off. And that back-off says, I'll only send in a slot with a given probability. Okay? So, when I first get it, I try to send. If there's no collision, that's good. I just stay in the same state. But if there is a collision, then I have to say in the next slot, with probability, only with probability P will I send. And how do you choose P? Well, we'll talk about that.
What exactly defines the collision?
Two senders sending in the same slot is a collision.
Okay.
All right? No. No, a collision means you're actually sending in the same slot. Okay? Just like cars. Two things in the same place at the same time is a collision. Okay. Picture. So the slots here are labeled as collision, empty, and success, C, E, and S. So in the first slot, you notice all three nodes have something to send, and they all send it, and there's a collision. Detected, everybody then says, with a different choice of random number, but choosing with probability P in each case, I will send in the next slot. We can all choose not to send. That results in an empty slot. And then the next time we choose again our random numbers and two of us try, that's a collision. Eventually somebody succeeds. And so on and so forth. So, what have we achieved here? One second. What have we achieved? That if there's only one node that wants to send, he can send at the full rate because there will be no collisions. Right? It's decentralized. There's no central management of this other than somehow agreeing on the slot boundaries. That is the time synchronization, which you can do by appropriate noticing of who's sending when as you join and sort of just learning what the slots are based on what you hear. And it's real simple. But there are collisions, there are idle slots, and if packets are not the full length of the slot, you're wasting stuff inside the thing. All right, anyway, question.
I was just going to say, it's just coincidence that after, during a collision, or after a success, there's an empty slot?
Just coincidence. Just coincidence. Because nodes 1 and 3, after node 2's success, well, throughout, until they succeed, nodes 1 and 3 keep deciding randomly whether to send in every slot or not. So that's just a random behavior. We're going to look on the next slide at sort of the characteristics of it. So, the question is, how much of the bandwidth will this scheme use? So you've got, the way they do this is they say, suppose there were infinitely many nodes, or take the limit as n goes to infinity. You have n nodes with frames to send. After the first slot, we'll ignore the first slot, we'll just say, because only one is going to survive, only one is going to succeed in the, no, none are going to succeed in the first slot, right? Because they're all going to try to send. So that's kind of an anomalous case. But once we get to the sort of a normal slot, then you get success when one node chooses to send and all the rest choose not to send. Right? So the not to send case is 1 minus p, and all of them have to choose that, so you know, they're independent selection from a random distribution. So that occurs with probability n 1 minus p to the n minus 1, and the other one also has to choose to send. So that's the probability that any given node succeeds in a slot. And the probability that any node succeeds is the sum of the probabilities for all the nodes. So that's n times p times 1 minus p to the n minus 1. Okay, so what you have to do is maximize p. Find the p that maximizes the utilization in each given slot. And I think that's a homework exercise. The p star depends on n. So if it's 2, it's probably 1 over n, right? So if you have n nodes to send, then probably each one should choose to send with probability 1 over p, but I don't remember, in order to maximize that. Let's see. I bet we can do it for 2. So what value of p maximizes, p star, maximizes 2 times p star times 1 minus p star to the 1. Well, that should be really easy to solve. That's 2p star minus 2p star minus 2p star squared. That's what we're trying to maximize. It's p star minus p star squared. So what value p star maximizes that? Anybody? Need a math genius here. Well, my guess is 1/2. Which would give us 1/2 minus 1/4 is 1/4, right? Let's try 1/3. That gives us 1/3 minus 1/9. a third is 0.33, and a ninth is 0.11, so that gives you 2/9, which is less than a quarter, right? So that's a good indication that a half is right. And going the other direction, what? 2/3? That would be 2/3 is 6/9 minus 4/9 is 2/9. Right. Okay. A half is at least a good guess. We'd have to use calculus otherwise.
I think
a half is correct too. It's the one that makes most sense as well, right? That if you have two nodes, then sort of in order to share fairly, they should each be choosing the same. Right. That's the other way to look at it. You want it to be fair. So all right. Okay. Anyway. Whatever. I guess if they all choose the same, it is fair. It's just not optimal. Anyway, so you figure out what P star should be, and then you calculate the limit as n goes to infinity of n times P star of n. Okay? And what you find out is you end up with you end up with 1 over E as the expected utilization. So about a third. So remember what utilization is. Or efficiency. It's the amount of work that you actually get done relative to the amount that you wish you could have gotten done, given the bandwidth of the link. Alright? So that's the kind of analysis that goes on for a protocol like this. Aloha, slotted Aloha requires clock synchronization, so what if you don't require clock synchronization? Then you get unslotted Aloha that uses the same sort of rules, but the collisions can extend over a longer period of time, because suppose it takes me this long to send my frame, right? Then somebody starting any time within one frame time before I start is going to collide with me, and anybody starting during my frame time is going to collide with me. Right? So this is worse than what we had before. And you work it out, and you get another factor of 2 in there, and so this Aloha protocol with multiple senders is not very efficient at all. 20%. Well, what's part of the problem here? Part of the problem here is, notice, that it was really stupid for him to start sending. Right? He should have been able to tell somebody was already using the network. Alright? So that's called carrier sensing. You look and see if somebody's already talking before you start talking. Gee whiz. We learned this in school. Well, we all learned it in our families, but we definitely learned it in school, that you don't start talking when somebody else is talking. And same thing here. Carrier sense. Alright, so carrier sense. You listen before you transmit. You don't start transmitting if somebody else is already talking. And if nobody's talking, you just start to send your frame, and that's good. But if it's busy, then you wait. You don't send. That's an improvement. So now we get into some pictures that are helpful to understanding this. You might think that would be perfect, right? But it turns out not to be, because we have this small problem of the speed of light. Right? Our senders are in different locations, and it takes time for signals to propagate from one place to another. And so I can start talking and end up colliding with what you were saying because I couldn't hear your signal at the time when I started talking, even though you had essentially, if we start at the same time or within a slight amount of time with each other. So these diagrams help understand that phenomenon. A, B, C, and D here are the different nodes. They're spread out in space. Okay? And these big triangles, sorts of things, not exactly triangles, represent the propagation of a signal, say, from B that starts at B at time zero and sometime later is, you see, visible at these points in space and eventually gets to A and again to C. Okay? But notice that D, if he starts sending in the time between when B started to send and when B's signal gets to D, he won't have heard B's signal. So he won't shut up like you wish he would. And so he does start sending, and as a result, the signal from D starts spreading, and eventually everybody noticed that there is, in this hashed area, a collision. Okay? So the message is destroyed. Both messages are destroyed. There was something else to say about this. Well, what should we do to improve this? What's bad about this? Again, we're wasting sort of all of this time that the collision is happening, right? So, it would be better if, recognizing that collisions can occur, we said, well, if I can see a collision occurring, there's no point in going on with my transmission. Right? So that is the idea of collision detection. It says we do everything we did with carrier sense, but then we also pay attention to whether collisions are occurring while we're sending. And if we detect a collision while we're sending, we stop. And that gives us a different picture. Looks like this. It's the same picture as before, but now instead of continuing to send during the time that the collision is occurring, we shortly after it occurs say, oh, there's a collision, and we stop, and that reduces, compared with the previous slide, the amount of time that this whole process takes. Remember? So previously it took from here all the way down to here before we were sort of cleared, the network was cleared of the traffic and we could re-begin. Right? Now, in this one, that's shorter. That's a shorter amount of time. So we've wasted less of the available time, and so this protocol will be more efficient. Uh huh.
So in that previous picture,
this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
T1 or the
red guy, I guess. Uh huh. The red guy detects the collision during this interval. Yeah, so he stopped. Notice he stopped sending right here at this time. Because his signal started later, it shows up, the collision occurs later over at B, and then he stops.
So both of them crash?
Yes, they both stop. You bet. When you detect a collision, you stop. Okay? Ah, well, that's a good point. You might have thought that, right? You might have said, well, B started first, D is being polite by stopping in order to let B go on. Why doesn't that work?
Because they can't tell.
No.
No.
Some
of the data is already corrupted anyway.
Exactly, right? The collision has occurred. B's transmission has been destroyed. There's no point in him going on.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
You could wish that there were, but it doesn't work that way. It's already been destroyed by the collision. So he'd better stop. Okay, well, collision detection is very helpful if you can do it. It turns out that in wired lands, and this was the brilliant insight that gave us Ethernet, was that Bob Metcalf was thinking about Aloha and saying how could it be improved in a wired setting, and he said, you can tell in a wired setting if somebody else starts transmitting, because essentially in a wired setting the voltage levels that you're putting on the wire together and the voltage levels that somebody else is putting on the wire are about the same, right? The resistance of the wire is very low. And so somebody else sending on the wire is going to make the voltage levels that you observe at your receiver look weird compared with what you're sending. Mm-hmm.
Would it make more sense to measure current levels? Because if you put let's say that you're transmitting at, say, 3 volts on one side, and then you put 3 volts on the other side, it's going to make your current go to zero, versus if you transmit on, if you put 3 volts on this side and not 3 volts on this side, it's going to make the current go that way. However it works, the current goes in a direction.
Right.
Like just difference of potential is going to make it.
Yeah, but you see, you don't have a way to really tell which direction the current is going. Right. You're just sort of measuring. The transmitter and receiver are measuring or putting a voltage across two wires. So you really can't tell which direction it's going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, now let me think. So that's the original Ethernet design. And then there was an Ethernet design that really could have done what you said. I don't know if it did, but it really had its... It was really configured like this. Right, and my circuitry was here. And you could have told which direction the current was going there, and I don't know whether it did or not. Okay. But regardless, in wired lands, this is straightforward, right? And Bob Metcalf thought of this in the early 1970s, and there's actually a picture of his napkin drawing of the Ethernet transceiver in the book. Actually, it's later in the slides as well. In wireless, this is much harder to detect collisions because in wireless, remember that when you send a signal in free space, what happens? It reduces in strength by the cube of the distance from the transmitter, physics 202, I think. right? A source of electromagnetic radiation at a given point radiating in all directions in three dimensions means that the signal strength is reduced by the cube of the distance. And so the problem then is that the thing that you're receiving is much, much weaker than the thing that you're sending and doesn't perturb it very much. So it's hard to detect a collision at the point where you're sending. The people who are just plain receiving will see the collision because the signal strength will be roughly equal between them and things will be corrupted. So, okay. 2 minutes to do taking turns. So, the partitioning algorithms don't do well for sharing when there's a light, when there's only one sender, right? They don't let one sender go fast. But when everybody wants to send, then they're fair and they're fast and efficient. The random access protocols are efficient at low load because a single node can easily use the whole channel. But at high load, you get lots of collisions and that reduces the effective efficiency. So, the taking turns protocols try to fix that by a couple of different schemes. One is, and this is used in a lot of industrial control systems, the master node repeatedly invites each of the slave nodes to send if they have something. Right? So there's a certain amount of overhead here associated with the time taken for polling. And there's also concern about you can't really send until you're invited to, which means that if there are a lot of people ahead of you, they'll get to go first. I don't see that that's so awful. It has to be that way one way or another. Then it's not really a distributed algorithm because the master is sort of in charge, and what happens if the master fails? So the other scheme for doing this sharing is a scheme called token passing. And so at the same time that Bob Metcalfe at Xerox was inventing the Ethernet, IBM Labs was inventing the token passing ring. And the idea here is that some node holds a token. When it has the token, it's allowed to send packets. Send a packet. When it doesn't hold the token, it's not allowed to send the packet, and the token gets passed around along with packets. And so you have your chance to send it. After you do that, you send the token to the next guy. If he has nothing to send, he passes it on. If he does, he sends his token. All right. So again, single point of failure. What happens if the token is lost? So that's what complicates this scheme, because there has to be a distributed algorithm to regenerate the token if the token is lost. Today, the IBM token ring is gone. It's not used anymore. But this token passing is used in optical fiber rings called sonnet rings. And so the idea lives on in a different technology than it was originally invented for. The Ethernet completely wiped out the token ring. It was so much simpler to implement that IBM sold token rings for 10 years or so and then just got out of the business because it couldn't compete with Ethernet. But then at the high end with Sonnet, very high bandwidths, being the taking turns is really worthwhile, and the extra expense in a very high-end product seems to be worth it. Okay? Next time, we'll talk about addressing.